Thank you.
I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. First thing I'd like to do is thank Sam for asking me to be here. Thank you guys for having me. I'd also like to thank those two guys right there for making the ride right here with me. It was a really nice drive. So, my sobriety date is July 26th of 2014. I've got a sponsor. He's sitting right there. He has a sponsor, and I'm willing to sponsor guys when asked. And I also have a home group that is the Outlaw Safe Cracker Group. We meet in Richmond on Monday nights and Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Just recently got babysitting, so it's a really great addition for us. And I have a service position in that home group. And I think, for me, that's been really, really important to my sobriety to have a service position, no matter what it is. I've done pretty much everything at some point since I've been a home group member there. And I'm really, really grateful to, you know, have some responsibility in AA, and also, you know, it's just crazy that a group of people could place their trust in me to get a job done for them and for AA in Richmond. But I'm really grateful that Sam asked me. It almost seems like it was close to a month ago to speak here, and you know, I'm glad it wasn't earlier this week, because that's all I'd have been thinking about this week. But I did all my thinking about what I was going to say, you know, maybe a couple days last month, and, you know, didn't think about speaking here, what I was going to say, until about 2 minutes ago, right before I stood up. So, but I asked God to speak through me tonight, because anything, you know, anything that I can think up, you guys don't want to hear. You guys don't need to hear. What you need to hear is the truth, and hopefully that's what's going to come out of my mouth, because that's the only thing I prayed for, was to convey a message through my own experiences with alcoholism, and hopefully you guys get something out of what I'm about to say. So I grew up in Richmond, and or outside of Richmond in Mechanicsville, and I don't remember, you know, a specific reason as to why I might have ended up an alcoholic. You know, it was a pretty normal childhood growing up. There wasn't anything that I felt that I didn't have. You know, both my parents were really great to me. My parents stayed together, which isn't always the case with us in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've, you know, through hearing other people's stories. But I had a really nice childhood growing up. I had an older sister. There was no animosity between us. That wasn't abnormal or anything like that. But what I can remember is from a very early age, and I kind of tell this little short story as to kind of give you an idea of when I can recall feeling the way I did. And my first, one of my earliest memories was when I was probably around 4 years old or so. I can remember back then my dad had a temper. You know, it all seemed normal to me when I was a little kid. You know, just dad got angry, and that's how, you know, that's what happened at home. And so, you know, there was one time he was doing some work, and I was all spread out on the floor in our house, and my dad was, I don't even know what my dad said, but I basically repeated a phrase that I had heard one of my parents say to me before, and that was, stop bitching about it. And I didn't know what it meant when I was 4 years old, but I said it, you know, probably in a cute little four-year-old voice, and my dad didn't like that at all. Chased me up the stairs, and I can remember, you know, just running as fast as my little legs could up to my room, closed the door and locked it before my dad was able to get up off the floor and get there. But then it kicked a hole through the door. And that, you know, I remember, the only thing I remember from that was, I don't know why my dad got so mad. I don't know why I got in trouble, you know. And that kind of became a theme growing up, you know, with other people and with relationships with other people, was, I don't know what I might do, you know, to make you angry with me, or, you know, always trying to find a way to make you like me so you don't get angry with me. So, as a little kid, you know, that's that's my MO. And I can remember going all the way back to fifth grade when people started telling me I was the nicest guy in school. You know, I was the nicest guy they knew. And I was like, yes, you know, that's what I wanted. And I worked really hard. I remember as a kid to make that happen. You know, I can remember thinking, okay, I've got, you know, a few friends. I had this friend over recently, so this other friend's not going to get mad at me. So, you know, I need to get him over to my house so, you know, he's not mad at me. And it was just always sort of like this play in the game with relationships and friends and stuff like that, that kind of carried throughout. And, you know, so I was shy, and I always felt a little bit different, as I've heard people say in here. You know, I had kind of going along into middle school and high school, I had a wide group of friends and different peer groups and stuff like that. But I always felt like if I was hanging out with the band kids, or if I was hanging out with the jocks or the other cool people or the not so cool people, whichever group of friends I was hanging out with at the time, they all seemed comfortable like that, you know. And I was able to dress the part, act the part, kind of do the things that they did to feel like I was accepted in that group. But I never feel like I accepted myself in that group, if that makes sense. Like, I never felt that, I felt each group was, you know, they had their circle, and I was there, but just standing on the outside, and that was everywhere I went. So when I got to high school, you know, I'm carrying all this stuff with me, and at the time I had no idea that I was feeling this way. You know, this is all, as I've gotten older, I've been able to look further back as to how I was feeling. And I remember just as a teenager just feeling really kind of irritable, testy, you know. On a given day, I'm not sure if I'm going to be happy or sad, and there was really no reason why or anything like that. But, you know, so I started doing some of the things that I saw as a child. I started getting angry, punching holes in walls and that sort of thing. And so from when I was probably about 15 was my first jaunt into counseling. And, you know, I went on my own accord because I was like, I don't like being this angry all the time. And now I know that was the time when I desperately needed a drink. And soon after that, you know, stuff kind of hit the fan at my, you know, in my home life. You know, mom and dad were fighting. Mom would be gone for a week or so, staying at a hotel, and dad would be doing the same thing. And it was around that time that, you know, found out my dad is drinking a lot more. And this is, you know, the first time I can remember my dad really drinking. You know, I know that my parents had a beer at dinner sometimes, but this was different. You know, there was a period of time where I didn't see my dad drink for a long time, and then I saw him kind of go off the deep end. And my poor mom didn't have too many people to talk to about it, and she wanted to talk to my sister and I, and I just sort of I got angry with her because I didn't know how to deal with uncomfortability, and just, you know, I didn't know how to act when I was uncomfortable. I didn't know how to show it. I didn't know how to deal with it. And, so things just continued to get worse there, and I started spending less time at home. And at this point, you know, I've made just this pact with myself, nobody else, that I'm not going to be like my dad, so I'm not going to drink. You know, I'm never going to drink. I'm never going to do drugs or anything like that. You know, which lasted maybe 3 years or so until I just right after my 18th birthday. So when I turned 18, I tried marijuana, and that was kind of what I did until I went to school. When I got to school, I ended up studying music at a school in Harrisonburg, and, you know, same thing. I sort of crossed this line, but I'm not going to cross this next line, you know, and that is something that also appeared a lot throughout my drinking was, you know, I would set, you know, the bar, I guess. I would set, I do not pass kind of sign, and I would always cross it. And I was always able to feel myself getting near it because I would start to make excuses. I would start to say things like, oh, I'm making way too big of a deal out of this. And that's what happened with alcohol. I remember going to my first party when I was 18 in college, and I'd never been to a party where there was drinking before, not even in high school. So this was brand new for me. It was like, I don't know, if I'm trying to think of a movie to compare it to, but it's like going into another civilization and just seeing like a bunch of savages kind of do their thing. You know, I felt like that's what it felt like to me. And I remember a guy, it was some guy's birthday, and they were all singing happy birthday to him, but he was being raised up in the air by two other guys, and he was completely passed out. And that kind of threw me for a loop. You know, I was like, is he okay? And everybody's like, yo, he's fine. And I just, you know, I don't remember feeling any different about my view towards drinking and, you know, I'm not drinking or I'm going to drink or whatever after that. But there was one night, not too far in the future. It was, you know, I was probably in school for maybe 4 months or so. It was the end of the first semester of college. And one night I just decided, you know, I'll try this drinking thing, you know, because I'd seen my roommates drink and nothing bad happened. You know, it wasn't like how it was with my dad. So I said, you know, okay, I'll try this drinking thing. Well, the only thing my roommate had to drink was a bottle of 189 proof Everclear, and he had gotten that from a party that the drum line at school had thrown, and all they had was 189 proof Everclear and a bunch of mixers and stuff like that. So I didn't know anything about alcohol. I didn't know what that meant. But I remember my roommate saying, okay, well, you know, if you want to try this, you should probably get something to drink with it. And so I did. I went downstairs to the vending machine, got a root beer. And I remember he mixed four shots of that and root beer, and it tasted to me like sparkling water. They've got flavored sparkling water. It's like you can barely taste the flavor sometimes. That was sort of how it was. It tasted like root beer essenced rubbing alcohol, essentially. And I remember I couldn't stand the taste. It burned. I didn't like it, you know. I've heard some people share that they liked that feeling the first time. I hated it. I thought it was going to come right back up, but it didn't. And I didn't want to finish drinking it, but my roommate told me, if you don't finish this drink, you're never going to want to drink again. And I was tired of feeling apart from my peers. You know, everybody I knew was drinking, even if it was just a little bit, they would drink a beer or something like that. I said, okay, I'm done being different from everybody else. I want to be a part of this thing too. So, drank it down. I had, I think, a Miller Lite that night. I thought it tasted like corn. And there might be video proof of that night somewhere floating around the internet. I hope to God there's not. But that first night I drank, I blacked out. And so I remembered some things up to a certain point, and then the next day, I didn't feel really hungover. I don't think, maybe it was just because it didn't take a lot to get me that way. And but what I do remember was people that I talked to that I'd seen the night before, they gave me this kind of attention that I hadn't gotten before. They thought I was funny. Everybody was focused on me, and that's what I wanted, you know. And they were focused on me until the joke kind of wore off. Like, Michael did all this stuff the night before. It was so funny. How do you not remember that? That's crazy. And I like that attention, but that's kind of how my drinking went for the foreseeable future. The first handful of times I drank, I got drunk and I blacked out. I didn't get the ball rolling, I would say, until later on. I sort of was doing the whole, I was a binge drinker for a long time in college. I would just wait until the weekends came by, and I would, you know, it was sort of like a competition between my roommates and I, who was going to find the person that was going to get us the alcohol for the weekend. And it was about this time also, probably second semester of my freshman year, that I realized nobody was making me go to class, and there weren't really any repercussions of me not going to class. And so I was able to sort of go to class when I felt like it, you know, do homework, not do homework. And it wasn't all from directly because I was drinking, but I know now that after I got what I got from drinking those first few times, you know, what I needed to get from school was no longer really on the table, you know. I would say the reason why I stayed in school for so long is more so to appease the powers that be, you know, my parents or my peers. You know, if I'm doing poorly in school and all my friends are doing well, I don't want to look bad, you know. So I did what I had to do. I manipulated whichever professors I needed to manipulate. And a lot of professors gave me some slack until they just got fed up with me. And that was probably around my junior year when I turned 21. And that year, it wasn't all that long ago. And even a couple years afterwards, I remember specifically when I was meeting with a counselor, a different counselor this time, a counselor again trying to sort of give her the history of what was going on with me. I couldn't remember anything from that year. I know that I can vaguely remember doing a lot of things that I thought were out of my character, doing a lot of things that I didn't think I would ever do or get involved in. But, you know, coming out of that haze for a while, I realized, you know, I just had more important things to do besides school. And around then was when I started to realize that I'm not feeling well mentally. I'm really depressed, you know. I want to die, and I don't know why. You know, nothing really tragic is happening to me. But, you know, I just know that – I knew that when I was sober, I didn't like the way my head felt. I didn't like my thoughts that were going on. I didn't like, you know, the way I felt when I was around other people. You know, I just felt, you know, like trying – it almost felt like I was trying to fit my entire world around me into a small bubble inside my head, and it just felt like it just wanted to pop, you know. And I couldn't stand that feeling. So I eventually told my parents backtrack a little bit. The year prior to that, my dad got sober. He got a couple DUIs in a couple weeks, ended up going to treatment, and I didn't want to have anything to do with him, you know. My mom had talked to me. She found out from a friend's mom that I'd started drinking, and she told me, you know, alcoholism runs in the family. And I told her, yeah, I know, you know, but I'm really keeping a lid on it. You know, I thought just the awareness of that, you know, like it's been talked about in meetings, you know, self-knowledge, you know, won't suffice. You know, no matter what I know about alcoholism, no matter how well I think I know what's going on in my head, that's not gonna keep me from, I'm not gonna beat alcoholism. So he tries to reach out to me, and I just completely, you know, ignore all of his calls. He called me every single night the 40 days he was in rehab, and I didn't answer a single one. Never called back. And because at the time I would have told you that I hated my dad, and you know, So when I told my parents, you know, that I was depressed, and at the time I told them that I was addicted to marijuana, they met with me in Charlottesville, and we talked about it and kind of decided that, you know, mind you, my dad's been in AA for about a year at this point, and kind of decided that I need to go talk to somebody about it. You know, not that maybe you should try going to some kind of meetings or something like that. It was, you know, I'm going to go to a counselor. That's what I did. I did the whole counselor thing. I did the treatment program and, you know, was the men's community leader. Thank you very much at the treatment center. And, you know, but that's because I was really good at just talking my way out of stuff, I guess. You know, I knew, or at least I thought I knew what those counselors at the treatment center wanted to hear. You know, I don't know why, but they had me lead a meeting, you know, while I was in there. And I felt like I had them snowed, you know what I mean? Because I knew, I was 22, and I knew that I didn't like the way I felt. But I was just too young to just not drink anymore, you know. Maybe this marijuana thing is the issue, but all my friends drink. You know, I still didn't know what an alcoholic was at this point, you know. I wouldn't have told you I was alcoholic. I thought an alcoholic was, you know, Vietnam vet that, you know, had PTSD and was just drinking in a brown paper bag under a bridge. That was literally what I thought, you know, my mental image of an alcoholic was, and that got broken down over time, of course. As you can see, I'm standing up here, but you know, so I got back from treatment, and I was able to manage for 4 months without going to any meetings, and I think the only reason why I lasted even that long was because I was living at home with my parents, and they said, you know, you can live here as long as you don't take a drink. And I tossed around the idea of how could I get this by over my dad, but my dad, you know, I've always known he was a pretty smart guy, and he knows me really well, and he knows alcoholism, obviously, so I knew that I wasn't going to be able to pull that one over, and I just hadn't reached that point with alcoholism that I still cared about keeping up appearances. You know, I wasn't going to go ask somebody if I could crash with them. You know, I thought I wouldn't be able to bring myself to do that. So, I lasted about 4 months. The night I'd take a drink again, I don't remember what I drank. I know I was camping, in the woods with my friend, in our neighborhood. And the last thing I remember was eating some baked beans from the fire. The next thing I remember, I'm laying in the middle of the woods in the middle of the night, you know, on my side, in my own vomit, just watching a deer walk by. And it was bright enough outside that I could see that I was in the woods and there was a deer right there. But I don't remember going back to my tent. I ended up waking up in my tent the next morning. But I remember for like a split second, the thought came over my head, what am I doing? You know, what's going on? But just as quick as it came, you know, the next morning, I didn't think about it again. And I sort of carried on and carried on. I went to school at JMU for 7.5 years, still don't have a degree from there. So that kind of shows you what, that was after my third year there. So the next 4 years or so, I would say the common themes were just, you know, trying to dig myself out of the hole that I got in, trying this medication with this psychiatrist, trying this substance abuse counselor, trying this IOP, until, you know, I just kind of gave up on all that. I didn't tell my parents I wasn't taking my medication anymore. I was just depressed as ever, you know, physically harming myself, doing things that, you know, just crossing the lines that I'd never thought I would cross. the things I said I would never, you know, it would never get that bad for me to actually want to do that. I found myself just reconciling those things. You know, for me, it was the, I had such pain going on inside my head, and, you know, I wanted to feel pain physically as well to sort of balance that out. And that was kind of my thought process, I guess, is kind of twisted. But, you know, and the reason I think I started feeling that way was because the solution that I had for a long time, drinking and just drinking until I can't think about those things anymore, goes, you know, drinking until all that stuff went away, it was no longer working. You know, I drink anything, you know. I remember the last time I drank liquor, it was the last time because my roommate at the time came in and she said that she could, that the entire apartment was just filled with like the reek of booze. And so I stopped drinking liquor at that point because I didn't want her to do anything to stop me from drinking. So I, you know, that's when I really started to hide what I was drinking. I can remember, you know, the last 2 years of my drinking, she would have a conversation with me from my doorway. And I remember as soon as she, you know, stopped talking to me, I'll close the door and walking back into my room. It was like, as soon as you take a couple steps in, it's just out from behind, you know, piles of clothes or a dresser here or a guitar lane, you know, guitar case there. So you take a couple steps in and all of a sudden like 36, 40 bottles just appear out of nowhere, you know. And I ran out of room in my dresser. I was no longer keeping my clothes in my dresser. They were just going on the floor, you know. And around the time I was doing that, you know, I didn't like change. So when the gas stations around me started making the plastic 40 bottles, I got really upset. But that was until I realized that they had bigger mouths so I could drink more quicker. And the neighbors wouldn't hear me when I finally would take those 40 bottles out to the dumpster. And so... you know, I thought that was kind of a victory, but, you know, I would do things like the winter time, I would go to the gas station, I would come back and, you know, I would have like a dirty clothes hamper in my car just for the purpose of putting a 40 in there and carrying my dirty clothes upstairs just so my roommate wouldn't know that I'm bringing 40s. And, you know, I'd hide one in the jacket. I would hide two in the snow outside of my apartment. I'd put like two sticks on the ground to make a cross over where I'd bury them in the snow and, you know, go outside to smoke or something like that and, you know, just walk right back in with another 40 bottle. And to this day, I don't know if she knew what I was doing. I thought that I was doing a really good job of hiding how much I was drinking. You know, I went to all sorts of different gas stations. The sheets right by my apartment told me that I was the only reason that they stocked the Mickey's 40 bottles. And I was really, really proud of that, let me tell you. But, you know, it kind of became, I mean, it was just constantly, all I'm trying to do is just keep my professors from being angry with me. I studied French horn at school, so I had the same French horn professor. We had a couple different ones come through, but the same one for the last 3 years of my drinking. And, you know, he knew a lot about my situation because I broke down to him a couple times and he really took an interest in helping me. But I was doing nothing to help myself. And eventually, you know, actions due directly to drinking the night before caused me to get kicked out of the school music and I had to audition to get back in. But he just got tired of helping me. And there are a couple people that did the same thing, you know. I thought I was hiding it really well from the people, you know, at school. There were a couple people that I knew that I was really, really close with, knew what was going on. They didn't say a lot to try to influence me, you know, to not drink or whatever. You know, one time a former roommate did try to have that conversation with me, and I threw the kitchen trash can at him, you know, and... So that's kind of how I would act. You know, I would try to cover my tracks. I'll try to keep everybody pleased all the while, you know, trying to figure out how am I going to get money to buy my 40s tonight. And they're like a dollar and some change, you know, but I didn't have any money. My parents stopped wiring me money for the calculator that I told them I needed for math class. You know, when I tried to ask my mom for money for that calculator on like two or three separate occasions, and she said, I know you don't have to buy three calculators. And so I would do that sort of thing. I would, you know, steal change from roommates to buy 40s and that sort of thing. But, you know, it got to the point where it didn't matter how much I drank. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen, if I was going to get drunk or not drunk. Sometimes I'd be able to drink just a very little bit and be drunk. There are times where I could drink until, you know, I literally couldn't fit anymore in my system, and I would just be sober as a bird, just stuck in, you know, whatever was going on that day. Most of the time it was just, you know, a blanket, I hate myself kind of thing. You know, I didn't know what to do at this point. I started smoking weed again and started having seizures from that. So I was able to stop and put that down. And that's kind of when I realized, you know, that's not really an issue for me, just because, you know, no matter what, I'm going to drink absolutely no matter what, no matter how I have to get the money to do it, I will get the money to drink that night. Hands down. But so I started running out of options of what I'm going to do. You know, I'm about to leave school, you know, either on my own will or I'm going to get kicked out. So I remember, you know, I was able to stop drinking for a couple days at a time. But, you know, when I would go home on breaks and stuff like that, I would hang out with friends and they would drink just like I did. So there was always plenty of opportunity to drink, and I would do that. And I remember there was one time around Thanksgiving, when I was maybe 24, I got a DUI, and that was one of those things that I told myself, I haven't gotten a DUI yet, I haven't lost a house yet, I haven't lost kids, I haven't lost a job, I've had no severe real consequences, so I thought, you know, from drinking. But then when I got this DUI, you know, it really kind of put a thought in my head that I really should just stop drinking. But I'd been partying all night with just a couple of friends, you know, the only people that would still hang out with me, because I'd known them my entire life. And, I remember driving off the side of the road very close to where I live now in Mechanicsville, kind of gave a tree a little love tap. Airbag didn't go off. There's no cosmetic damage to the car except for a busted headlight. But I called my best friend, and he was going to pull me out with the chains from his truck, and he arrived about 20 seconds too late. You know, two state troopers pulled up behind me, and they asked me to get out of the car, obviously, and I did the whole field sobriety test. I don't remember what I told them, where I said I was going. All I know is that they told me I would have passed the field sobriety test if I hadn't told them I was going to a location that was the exact opposite direction where I was telling them. So they could tell I didn't know where I was, really. And to this day, I still don't know. I know I've been told before, but I don't know what side of Mechanicsville Turnpike I got pulled over on. I know the kind of the stretch of road, but I don't know which direction I was really going. But, you know, I did the field sobriety test, and they breathalyzed me. The first breathalyzer was one of those where it's just sort of like, you know, three tiers. Like, you're either sober, you're drunk, or you're really drunk. And, of course, I kind of went to the top tier. And they said, well, we need to get another breathalyzer out here. So they got, you know, some squad car that had, like, specially equipped with the big breathalyzer, and they pulled it out, and that might have taken like 10 or 15 minutes or something like that, and I blew in it, and I blew a .297, and they said, you know, we don't see how you're able to, you know, do the sobriety, field sobriety test when you blow that high, so we're going to, you know, breathalyze you again when we get to the station. And I remember having two thoughts when I was told that. And the first thought was, you know, wow, I'm pretty good at this drinking thing, actually. And then the second thought, which came really, really, really quickly after that, was normal people don't do that. Normal people can't blow a .297 and walk in a straight line or stand on one foot and say the alphabet backwards or whatever I had to do, you know. And so getting into the squad car and on the way back to the police station, I don't really remember. But when I got to my holding cell, I remember that was the only thought that I had really going on. It was like, normal people don't do that. Normal people would not even be standing up, probably. I don't know. But I'm pretty sure they wouldn't. But, you know, maybe 12 hours later, my mom bails me out. And, you know, after that, it's just all the legal garbage that kind of just comes with that. And I started taking this idea seriously that I'd been thinking about a little bit. Maybe I should stop drinking. Maybe I am an alcoholic. I don't really know. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. But it does ruin the family, so I was bouncing around these ideas. And, you know, before my court date, my dad, I went to AA meetings when I was in treatment, but honestly, I don't remember a single word. But I do remember the first meeting that my dad took me to after I was arrested, and it was at St. Stephen's in Richmond, and it was a discussion meeting. I don't remember what was shared. I remember being relieved that there were a couple people around my age in that meeting, but then still, you know, having this feeling like I don't belong here because I'm a kid and, you know, I'm a musician and or whatever, you know, unique thing I thought I had about me. I did that a couple times. I went to a meeting with my dad, and more so to get the heat off my back from my parents. I ended up moving back home, stopped going to school. I moved back in with my parents to get sober, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if I was going to stay sober, but I remember my last drink. I'd been commuting from JMU to Richmond one day a week for this, I guess it was kind of like an IOP program. But I remember I was drinking it throughout the entire program. There were a couple times I got caught. There were a couple times I didn't. And they, it wasn't court ordered, so I didn't get in any real big trouble. But I remember when the night before my parents came to help me move out of my apartment, it was just a normal night of drinking. I had, you know, like 3 40-ounce bottles of Mickey's, and that was just what the normal was for me at the time. And I woke up the next day and packed up and left, and I came home, and I didn't have a thought about going to an AA meeting. I didn't know what I was going to do. I knew I was going to have to find some kind of a job at some point, but right now, you know, in my fragile state or whatever, I was just going to try to take it easy and try not to drink. And I met with a lawyer to talk about my DUI case, and he told me, if you don't want to go to jail, you need to go to AA meetings, you need to get a home group, you need to get a sponsor, and you need to meet with that sponsor. You might have said, you know, a couple other things, but I agreed with him. I said, you're exactly right. This is, you know, this is what I need to do. And I didn't, you know, I didn't do those things, and I went to jail. And, so, you know, I was in jail for about 10 days, and, you know, while I was in there, a couple times I thought about what I was going to do when I got out, and the thought just came to my head that I need to go back to this one meeting that I used to check out every so often. You know, I would go to an AA meeting by myself maybe once every couple weeks, And this one that I'll go to is Jaywalkers. And so the first Tuesday after I got out of jail, I got out of jail on a Saturday. It was the day after Christmas. So the following it might have been a week and a half or 2 weeks before I finally went to this meeting, but I went to this meeting. Didn't think I was going to find a sponsor. Didn't think I was going to get a home group or anything like that. You know, I just thought I would check it out and try to do. I finally got to the point where I was like, you know, I was in jail thinking about I was going to be a high school band director and I was going to teach kids how to play music. You know, I was going to, you know, finish school and get a bachelor's degree. I probably thought about a bunch more things, but just seeing where I was, there's no way I could have fathomed being in that place, you know, just even a couple years prior. And, you know, I had a couple other big emotional consequences that, you know, it's a story too long for this meeting, but a couple consequences that, you know, I crossed another line that I didn't think was completely... In any alternate universe, it was not possible for me to do these things and to you know, feel the repercussions of that. But I had, you know, and I had wronged some people terribly. And so when I was in jail, I remember thinking, there's no way I can keep going like this. I'm done. I hate drinking. You know, drinking doesn't work for me anymore. I don't want to drink. You know, and just thoughts like that, just animosity towards drinking, you know, I guess you could say. But so I got out of jail and I went to this meeting. And I remember I shared from the podium that night, probably said a whole lot of stuff about me and how I was feeling. But luckily, I talked to a guy, that guy right there. I talked to James after the meeting. I think he came up to me, actually. I think he was doing a good job. I think he came up to me afterwards and talked to the guy who knew. It was obvious I was brand new because I'm just, you know, spitting my garbage all over everybody. And so we talked a little bit about drinking. I think I probably did most of the talking. And I told him I was looking for a sponsor and said, well, you know, there's a ton of great, you know, great guys that are here tonight that have been sober for a while that would be a great sponsor. And I think I just asked him if he would consider being my sponsor, and he said, yeah. And he laid out the things he wanted me to do. He wanted me to call him the next morning at 8 a.m. You know, he wanted me, I don't know if he told me this then or after the first time we met, but he wanted me to wear a collared shirt to every meeting. He wanted me to wear pants to every meeting. He wanted me to call at least four guys a day. And those are the big major things that he wanted me to do. And, you know, said if you can do those things, then I'll sponsor you. And so I said, yeah. Oh, he told me that he wanted me to go to his home group on Thursday night. And I said, okay. So I realized much later that was the first time I had said okay to anybody that was giving me the directions. And I didn't expect them to owe me a favor down the line. You know, I said okay, and I didn't have any sort of, like, you're wrong, but I'm going to say okay anyways. You know, I didn't have any ideas anymore. I was fresh out, and what I'd been doing just obviously wasn't working. I tried to think myself out of, you know, drinking every single day, but I couldn't, you know. So I went to this home group meeting, the Outlaw Safecracker group, and he asked me, if I wanted to stay for the business meeting afterwards, and I said, yeah. And after the business meeting, he told me I should stay for the business meeting afterwards, and I did. Told me I should join the home group after the business meeting, and I said, okay, you know. So I got a home group and a sponsor, and we started meeting and going through the book, you know. And he read the first 164 pages to me, and I listened as best as I could at the time. You know, my attention span wasn't great, but we went through those 164 pages and we talked about it, you know. And whenever we got to a step, you would point out, you know, when I needed to take some action. And one of the things he told me early on was that, you know, in this program, it requires you to do things, to take some very simple actions. And one of those for me was he had me greet people at my home group. And I told him, that's probably, you know, I don't know if you know, but I'm really kind of got some social anxiety going on. He said, that's why you're going to be a greeter. And so I greeted for, I mean, I don't think I ever really stopped being a greeter. I still greet every single night at my home group. And at first I couldn't look people in the eye when I shook their hands. It was always this internal battle of, like, when do I stick out my hand? What do I say? Do I, like, ask them what their name is? Do I tell them my name? You know, how long do I shake for? How long do I look into their eyes? Like, what if someone else passes me? All this stuff going through my head. But what I learned from that was, you know, I've got to take some suggestions. And this is what I've gathered a long way since then, not, like, right after I started doing it. But I've got to take some suggestions. I have to be willing to take some suggestions from people who've been able to stay sober. And these are really simple suggestions that I'm not always going to feel comfortable with. I'm not always going to see, you know, how is this going to keep me sober, you know. Obviously, anything I thought was going to keep me sober didn't. So I was, for the first time, I was able to sort of take directions, even if they didn't make sense to me. And, you know, now greeting people at my home group or greeting people anywhere in AA is just not what it was. You know, it's so much easier, and I feel like I can look people in the eye now. And that's just from taking a simple suggestion from my sponsor. And I've been taking suggestions from plenty of other people in the group and throughout AA. And every single time, you know, every single time I do these things that they suggest, you know, when they say, this is what I do in this situation, or when I get to my home group, this is what I do, or when you see a new guy that you haven't seen before, talk to him. You know, when I take these suggestions, you know, a lot happens. I get out of myself. You know, I'm not thinking about myself all the time when I'm trying to reach out to other people, and that's something that was always a problem for me, you know, a lot of us, I think. But you know, we went through the steps, and you know, did a fourth step to the best of my ability. There's still a couple amends that I have to make from my eighth step list. Most of those are from lack of willing to travel, I guess you could say. So a lot of them are easy amends to make. They just require a lot of travel. I don't do this program perfectly, you know. I do the best I can every single day. And sometimes, actually, that's a bold-faced lie. I don't do the best I can every single day. I see that I'm running out of time. But what I've come to realize recently, I talked about this in a meeting last week, I think, was I was never really good at praying at the beginning. Still not great at it, but I do it a lot now. I pray every single night, maybe out of the month, probably miss like two nights or so. But I pray every single night. I get on my knees and I pray right next to my bed. And just the things I pray for have, just in the past 5 or 6 months, have changed a whole lot, you know. It was really basic, God, thank you for keeping me sober today kind of things. Nowadays, it's a lot more conversation-like, and I've come to accept that the things that I pray for might not always come true, or, you know, the things I pray for not happening might happen. But when I do constantly and consistently pray, God provides me with things that I need, you know. And they show up in a lot of different ways, but I guess that's all I have, and thank you all for having me.